There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Welcome back to the show. Just fast approaching 10 past 5 on your Saturday afternoon. Beautiful afternoon down here at Baraste. Do pop on down to the rooftop. 25% off selected beverages. If you are looking to watch the football, the rugby, then this is the place to do it. Mark Archer, Carl Van Roosevelt, alongside myself, Chris McCarty. We are looking not only at the football early kickoff in the Emirates FA Cup, but it is quarter-final weekend. It's Swansea against Tottenham. There is also the small matter of Italy taking on Scotland in the first of three matches to conclude the Rugby Six Nations for 2018. Mark Archer's got the details of what is going on over at Stadio Olimpico.
Yeah, the first of today's triple header in the Six Nations, the final round of this year's Six Nations, is in Rome. It's Italy hosting Scotland, and I can tell you that the home team leads Scotland 17 points to 12 with 3.5 minutes remaining in the first half. Two tries apiece. Tommaso Allan with the first try. The man who actually played for Scotland under 18 but now plies his trade for Italy. He scored and converted the first try. The second try was the Italian fullback Matteo Mazzotti. That got Italy up to 17. Two tries for Scotland. Fraser Brown, the hooker, scored the first try, and then the captain John Barclay scored the second try from a driving maul conversion also to Greg Lainlaw. So a couple of minutes remaining in Rome. It's Italy 17, Scotland 12.
We'll stick with rugby if we can. Not only Northern Hemisphere, there is Super Rugby as well. Carl Van Roosevelt?
Yeah, what I can tell you, Chris, one live game coming to you from Cape Town in South Africa. It's the Stormers taking on Sonny Bill Williams' Blues. And what I can tell you is the Stormers have scored the opening try through Evia Philune in the second minute. That was converted by fly-off Damian Willems, to the Stormers leading 7-0. Two games played earlier this morning. The Highlanders beating the Crusaders, and that was a huge result for them there in Dunedin. And the Brumbies beating the visiting Sharks 24 points to 17.
It is halftime over at the Liberty Stadium between Swansea City and Tottenham Hotspur. This, the opening game of the Emirates FA Cup quarter-final weekend. I can tell you it's Swansea 0, Tottenham 2. It was Christian Eriksen, the Dane, who gave Tottenham the lead. A fantastic finish early on, just 11 minutes on the clock. A 25-yard left-footed shot that just beat Nordveit in the Swansea goal, all hands up. Swansea have lived dangerously. Tottenham did have a goal disallowed for offside. We're watching replays of it now. Heung-min Son, who was adjudged to have been, and I'm talking, well, it's millimetres offside. Probably the right decision after the VAR came into play. That goal was ruled out just for offside. Christian Eriksen then hit the crossbar before Eric Lamela scored the second for Spurs. A wonderful finish. Just rolled the ball over the sole of his foot, not once but twice. Opened it up, right foot into the bottom corner. Spurs very much in control of this one. Half-time down at Liberty Stadium. It is Swansea 0, Tottenham 2. As for the Championship, early kickoff in that one, it's all West London derby. It's Fulham taking on Queen's Park Rangers. Fulham, what form they've been in recent weeks. They currently lead Queen's Park Rangers by a goal to nil. It is the Scottish international, a man that is interesting a number of Premier League clubs, Tom Kearney, with the goal. So Fulham 1, QPR 0. We're going to break away from rugby and football because, well, let's talk golf. Robbie Greenfield is on holiday. He will be somewhere, I'm sure, delighted with the fact that we're talking golf, and we will do so in a lot of detail because it is the Arnold Palmer Invitational over at Bay Hill. Tiger Woods has been quite rightly dominating a lot of conversations across the globe in recent weeks for his, well, I guess, renaissance, or at least impending renaissance. He's on the way back to somewhere close to his best, but it's Henrik Stenson and a young man by the name of Bryson DeChambeau who lead the way.
Yeah, let's just set the scene because this is one event that Tiger has dominated in his years as a professional golfer. He's won there 8 times, which is more times than many pros win professional golf tournaments. Let's just set the scene about Tiger and his success at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. It takes place at Bay Hill, Orlando, Florida.
Tiger Woods is a winner again.
He's gotten more wins in one event than most guys do a whole career.
With 8 wins and 13 starts at the Arnold Palmer Invitational presented by MasterCard, Tiger Woods has dominated Bay Hill like no one else.
It is over.
The king watching more greatness from Tiger.
One of the more dramatic finishes.
The event itself has meant a lot to me because of I lived there in Orlando for 18 years and got a chance to develop a relationship with Arnold.
We present the winner of our tournament with a jacket. Tiger Woods is hogging up all the jackets. we had to put a special group on to manufacture jackets for Tiger.
Again at Bay Hill!
Be able to win it and to have, you know, the King there, you know, give me a big handshake and a hug throughout the years. It's very close to my heart.
Number one in the world again.
His eight victories are tied for the most in a single tournament in tour history. And he's contributed significantly to the rich history of the Signature 18.
That is this week's PGA Tour event, the Arnold Palmer Invitational, taking place at Bay Hill. And there was a little piece about Tiger's success. He's currently 4 under par after 2 rounds over in Bay Hill. He's continued the good form he showed last week at the Valspar Championship, where he had a chance to win going to the final round. There was Englishman Paul Casey that got the victory there after many years not winning an event. But Paul Casey back to form. But Tiger showing the consistency now to look in contention. We're only a couple of weeks away from the first major of the year, of course, the Masters at Augusta. And all of a sudden, Tiger Woods has become a factor again. But just to quickly look at the top of the leaderboard, they're tied for first. Well, it's the Iceman and the Scientist. It's Henrik Stenson from Sweden, 11 under par. The Iceman and, of course, the Scientist, a man that's played a couple of years regularly over here in the Middle East, Bryson DeChambeau. Unorthodox, yet effective. They're both 11 under par. Henrik Stenson had a wonderful first round of 64. So he's at rounds of 64-69 for his score at 11 under par. Third place, Tyler Gooch, 2 shots back, 9 under par. Baeyong Hoon An, this from South Korea, 8 under par. And in fifth place, Charlie Hoffman. But notable other scorers, a lot of big-name players honing their game for the Masters. The greens look lightning fast here at Bay Hill. It's what they get at Augusta. And a lot of big-name players doing pretty well. Just run through some notable other scores. Ricky Fowler, 6 under par. Rory McIlroy, trying to find some form, missed the cut last week. He's at 5 under par, starting to find some game on those fast greens. Ernie Els, 5 under par. Good to see the Big Easy putting in a good couple of days' work. Justin Rose, 4 under par. Bubba Watson, 4 under par. And Tiger Woods. So many of the good players really coming to the fore. Let's just have a quick listen to the Iceman, Henrik Stenson, post-round yesterday after his round of 69.
Putting more than anything, but a combination putting and my shots. I mean, I've been hitting a few really close this week, both days. And obviously, if you're rolling it nicely, you're setting up some good opportunities from 3-4 feet. Today wasn't as good as yesterday, obviously. But the important part for me was 16, 17, 18. I scrambled for par all those three holes after hitting some not so good golf shots, kept patient, and then I got on a string that made 3 in a row on 5, 6, 7 coming home. So 3 under on this golf course is never bad.
Speaking of your putting, we've been talking a lot about the speed of the greens. Are these the fastest you've seen all year?
Yeah, given that it's my second tournament on the PGA Tour, they were pretty quick in the Middle East on the European Tour times. But I mean, it's Bermuda greens, and when you're on the high side, you're coming down the hill, down grain. They're definitely slick, and you got to be careful every time you're on the high side, and that's why it's so important to leave your approaches on the lower side of the hole.
Getting technical is Henrik Stenson there, but a wonderful couple of days for the Swede. A 64, 8 under par in his opening round. Backed that up with a 69. He is co-leader at the halfway stage alongside Bryson DeChambeau. Nice to see Stenson playing himself into a bit of form as well, Carl.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, as you said, it's only his second tournament on the PGA Tour, and I think the course is kind of set up for Stenson. You have to be very, very accurate with your irons, and also you have to have a good driving game on the day, because if you get it wrong off the tee, Chris, things can change very quickly for you, like Rory McIlroy experience in round number one, you know, double bogey on 18, which left him at 3 under par. So, yeah, Stenson looking in very, very good shape. Another player mentioned by Archie a little bit earlier, Ernie Els, our very own Ernie Els, looking very good at 3 under par after missing the cut at the Valspar. And also a big congratulations to Ernie Els. He's been named the President's Captain for 2019. Him and Tiger will be going up against each other. So I think that's fantastic to see. But, you know, to me, the one thing that I'm taking out of the Bay Hill Invitational is how much respect all the players have got for Arnie, and how much he meant to all the players. And, you know, in a lot of interviews, a lot of players will go, you know, Arnie wrote me a specific letter, or he said something to me, or he put his arm around me. And I think it's kind of fantastic. You know, Ricky Fowler's whole kit is all a tribute to Arnold, the great Arnold Palmer, his shoes, you know, with Arnie's name on it and so forth. So it really is a fantastic tournament. And as I say, I think the big thing taking out of this tournament is that we're seeing a lot of players return to form. And to me, with Tiger Woods back should I say, in the driving seat or in the competitive seat, I think golf is so much of a better game.
Absolutely, no doubt about that. You just need to look at how much attention, how much has been written about golf in the last few weeks. It's a different world, Mark. You've been involved in golf, I know, from a marketing perspective, an agency as well. You know what golf is, and you know the impact that Tiger Woods has on it, taking nothing away from the other players, and whether he wins or not, it's the fact that he's competing first and foremost. It's the fact that he is semi-competitive, or is competitive, as we saw over at the Valspar. It just adds to the narrative, if you will, of golf, with Tiger Woods fit, healthy, and on the golf course.
Yeah, I mean, most of the column inches and the radio talk and TV talk about Tiger in the recent few years has all been negative, or comebacks that have failed, and his injuries and his off the course issues. It's great to talk about Tiger playing good golf again and scoring. And look, the very basic fact last week is when he was on the leaderboard going into the final day on the Sunday, the TV rankings for any PGA Tour event were the highest it's been in almost a decade last weekend. So when more people are watching on TV and more people are turning up to golf courses, more money going into the game, everyone's benefiting. The other players are benefiting, Tiger Woods is benefiting, and golf's a better game for it. And look, he's now in his 40s, he's a mature player. But if one guy can turn it on and has some muscle memory and some winning experiences at Augusta, it's Tiger Woods. It's one course where we know he's played some of his best golf in his career. He's won multiple green jackets, and we're only 2 weeks away from the first Masters of the year. So it's just good to see him playing well and looking healthy, and his swing looks better, and his short game's improved because it was terrible. And when he's putting well, he's the best putter of all time. I mean, people have said that when he's on his game, and that's what wins majors, when you're on the form there. And if any player can conquer those tough greens at Augusta, it's Tiger Woods.
Yeah, well, as you're saying, I don't know what it stands like this week, Chris McCarty, but after last week's performance, Tiger Woods is now second favorite for Augusta, and I think that what a long way he's come. And I actually don't believe we're giving Tiger enough credit. These operations he had, it's no small operations. He's literally come back. What's he played? 4 or 5 tournaments, and now he's going in as second favorite to Augusta. Honestly, absolutely fantastic. I'm just so glad to see him back and being competitive once again.
And the strange thing about it is, in a weird sort of way, statistics, we almost don't want him winning this weekend, because stats show that it's very rare that players win back to back. So Tiger playing himself into a bit of form will just mean there's that much more intrigue when he rocks up to Augusta National. It's a course he knows well. It's a tournament he's won not just once, he's won it multiple times. And dare we say it, could we see on that Sunday, all I ask for, I don't even need Tiger to win this event, what I want though is for him to be in the mix on Sunday. That is where the eyeballs will come. That is where the intrigue, that is where the excitement will come. If on that final Sunday at the Masters in a few weeks' time, Tiger Woods, a couple of shots off the lead, final Sunday, wearing the famous red shirt, I can just picture the scenes right now. And then to even think of him going on and winning it, my goodness, it would be the best story of the year.
It's pretty tough to write him off this week. He's won this event 8 times.
Yeah. He needs a big round today.
Yeah, he needs to go really low. Probably shoot a 64 to have a chance and a few players to come back to him, because he is 7 shots behind the leaders. That being said, it's the type of course where he's done so well. If he gets in a bit of roll, gets momentum, gets the crowd behind him and holds some putts, anything can happen. But as you say, look, at the Masters, it would be great to have him in the mix. What we've wanted is this generation. We've seen some great winners of majors in their 40s in recent years. We've seen, whether it be Phil Mickelson or Darren Clarke, we've seen some older players win major events. Tiger Woods hasn't won a major for a decade. He hasn't really been consistently performing in a long time now. And we've wanted him to go head-to-head against a Rory McIlroy playing at his best, against a Dustin Johnson playing at his best.
Jordan Spieth.
A Jordan Spieth playing at his best. And that was what we want. That would be amazing for golf to see Tiger Woods, arguably the greatest player of all time, arguably a guy that changed the game when he's played it, to take on these young guys now who've won a couple of majors in their 20-somethings or early 30-somethings. That would be exciting. That would be great for the game of golf.
Yeah, needs a big round. It is moving Saturday, as Archie likes to say, over at Bay Hill. And if Tiger Woods can shoot, I don't know, a 65, a 66, then he puts himself very much into contention to win this week as well. When we come back, we'll keep the conversation flowing on the grill. Keen to put you in the picture of a big announcement locally this past week. It's to do with cycling. I'll get CVR and Archie's thoughts on that one when we come back.
This is The Grill. Get involved with the show. Text 4001 or message us for free on the Dubai Eye Messenger app.
keep your thoughts coming in on 4001. We'll get to some of your texts in just a moment. One or two of you having your say in a couple of the subjects we've been discussing this afternoon. Going to just switch tack just for 5 minutes or so, because it is worthwhile just shining the spotlight on the world of cycling for a moment or two, because it pertains to a couple of massive events that have been growing in stature and in importance and in popularity, it's fair to say, over the course of the past few years. That is both the Dubai Tour and the Abu Dhabi Tour, because massive announcement this past week that both of those events are, well, they'll cease to exist because they've moved now to a tour of the UAE. Seven stages across all seven Emirates. It's been a move that I've been calling for both publicly and privately, because I think it is the way to go. I think it adds more credence to the UAE and certainly to cycling, to have one event that covers all the Emirates. Reaction to the news that we will see a UAE tour? Good move for you, Archie?
Yeah, I think your common sense has finally prevailed. And look, we know that both those events, the Dubai Tour and the Abu Dhabi Tour, are both relatively new, within sort of the 5 years old of each. And it just makes a lot of sense to merge two really, really strong events to create what you'd call a great world tour event. The Abu Dhabi event's been a world tour event, which puts you on the top echelon of global cycling events. Some of the best cyclists, particularly sprinters, yeah, come over and take on both those races. And now we're going from, I think the both tours are either four or five stages. They're now going to a seven-stage event spread across all the Emirates. And it's good for cycling to concentrate in there. Just think of how the strength now of what we've seen gets combined to have some great routes and challenging routes, and spread it across the Emirates. And some, I think, I've got no doubt, the very, very best cyclists in the world will come to the UAE and take part in the UAE Tour.
That's the beauty of it, I guess. It has been a haven for the sprinters, the likes of Marcel Kittel, a two-time winner over here in Dubai, Mark Cavendish. We've seen Elia Viviani, some of the elite names in the world of sprinting. It now opens itself up, because I would imagine the likes of Jebel Jais and Ras Al Khaimah, Jebel Hafit, Hatta Dam, all of those come into play for a UAE Tour. You might throw in a time trial, and you can now be a little bit more creative on what you do with the route. So, dare I say it, it's maybe a little premature to say this, but it opens itself up to a Peter Sagan. It perhaps opens itself up to a Chris Froome, for example. Yes, it's early on in the season, and I know they've all got their own schedules and their own preparation, lead-up time to the big one, which will always remain the Tour de France, but it is exciting for cycling.
Absolutely. You know, Chris, the saying goes, bigger is not always better, but I definitely think in this case it is, and I think, you know, it gives every cycling fan a wonderful opportunity to see these races that's combined. And just adding to what you said, it will definitely attract bigger names, Chris. All of a sudden, you know, this becomes a much, much bigger event spread over the Emirate. And as I say, I'm sure we'll be seeing these bigger names coming out to the UAE. And also, I think it will be much more competitive than what it's been. Not saying it hasn't been competitive as the two individual races, but I kind of feel with the one approach, much stronger, much better for the future.
Absolutely. And it's a good time if you're a cycling aficionado, because there's a lot of great moves being done. We've been promoting and we've actually been backing the UAE Road Cycling Championship, which is an event for the amateur cyclists out there, the Dubai 103.8 UAE Road Cycling Championship. It came to a conclusion last weekend. Two stages in its inaugural edition, but as we heard from Jeff O'Brien on Onside Sports, the man, the mastermind behind the UAE Road Cycling Championship, big plans for the future, four, perhaps five stages in the next edition from September. That is for the elite amateurs, if you will, the Spinnies 92 cycle. So much going on for amateur cycling, you know, enthusiasts. It's a great move, and to have an elite event that now is ties in together all of the Emirates, it can only be good news for cycling. It is one of the fastest growing sports over in this part of the world, and that's not going to change anytime soon. An awful lot of cycling fans out there that take to the roads daily, weekly, down there at Al Qudra, down there at the Yas Marina Circuit as well, various points around the UAE that you can go cycling in a safe environment. And I'm all for a UAE Tour. Let us know your thoughts on that one on 4001. We've been talking Tiger Woods and what a great comeback it is. Well, it's shaping up to be for the great man. What about Scotland in action? They are the opening match, Scotland against Italy, in this opening weekend, or final weekend, should I say, of the Rugby Six Nations. Halftime score in this one?
Yeah, halftime in Rome. It's the first of three Six Nations matches today, the final weekend of the Six Nations Championship. And it's the home team that lead. It's Italy, yet to win a match and have winless in the Six Nations for actually a couple of years now, lead Scotland 17 points to 12. Two tries apiece. Tries to Italy for their fly half, Tommaso Allen, who's also kicked a couple of penalties and conversions, and Matteo Mazzotti, the fullback for Scotland. The hooker, Fraser Brown, scored the first try, and the captain, John Barclay, scored from a driving maul. A couple of conversions there to Greg Lainlaw. So half-time, well, second half's just about to get underway in Rome. It's the hosts, Italy 17, Scotland 12.
Give us an update, if you can, Carl, on the Super Rugby.
Yeah, it's very one-sided. 23 minutes played, Chris McCarty. And what I can tell you is, well, the Stormers have just had a try disallowed. So it's two tries to the Stormers. The Stormers leading the Blues 14 points to 3. And what I can tell you, an informer has told me, that Sonny Bill Williams is in Cape Town this weekend, as well as David Warner.
Yes, David Warner making the headlines in the past couple of weeks. And we're going to get to cricket when we come back, because the UAE, they've done wonders over in Zimbabwe, securing their ODI status. We'll look back, and we'll certainly look ahead as well to the remainder of the Super Sixes over there in World Cup qualifying in the world of cricket. Kiyiso Rabada, he will have to discuss the goings-on over there in Port Elizabeth in that second test between South Africa and Australia. Just very quickly, put you in the picture of the latest in the football. It is Emirates FA Cup quarter-final day. Swansea taking on Tottenham, 55 minutes on the clock. It remains Swansea 0, Tottenham 2. Christian Eriksen and Eric Lamella on the score sheet for Spurs. As for the Championship, couple of early kickoffs there. It is the West London Derby down at Craven Cottage this afternoon. High-flying Fulham taking on struggling QPR. It's Fulham 2, QPR 1. And it's Barnsley down at the wrong end of the table. They're taking on Millwall, another London side. And I can tell you it's Barnsley 0, Millwall 1. Lee Gregory on the score sheet for Millwall. When we come back, we're talking all things cricket. Keep your thoughts coming in on 4001.
This is The Grill. Get involved with Dubai Eye on Facebook.
Welcome back to the show. I did say a little earlier that I expected Scotland to get a victory over in Rome, and I've just jinxed the boys because Italy are inspired.
Well, we've also had Carvin Roosevelt saying that Italy shouldn't be part of the Six Nations, but giving them that mass, and Scotland maybe shouldn't be part of the Six Nations either. Maybe we'll become the Four Nations, Carl. We'll get rid of Italy and Scotland, because 42 minutes, 2 minutes gone into the second half, and Italy have scored their third try of the match to Sebastian Negri. It's a backline move. It's come, it could be under review here for a potential knock-on, but I don't think it's a knock-on.
That's fine. Put them back into the Six Nations now, Arch.
But it's the big number eight, Sergio Parisse, making a run. The ball's been passed through the backline. It's been fumbled, but the result is that Sebastian Negri has scored the try. It's still under review at the moment, but it looks though that it's been awarded, and it looks though it'll be a very kickable conversion to Tommaso Allen. So at the moment, conversion to come. It's the third try for Italy. They lead 22. Oh, it's been disallowed.
Yeah, I thought that.
Oh, controversy there. Controversy. Carl and Chris live for another day with their comments. So it's still 17 points to 12, but it's fair to say Italy have played most of the rugby in the first half. They've started the second half strongly. Just had a try disallowed by the TMO. They still lead Scotland 2 minutes into the second half, 17 points to 12.
Yeah, definite knock-on there. Absolutely definite. No doubt about that one. But Italy inspired at this moment in time. Scotland struggling to get a foothold in this one. 43 minutes on the clock, as Archie rightly points out. Italy with that 5-point lead. Want to talk cricket now, if we can. It has been, well, it's been a week of a lot of controversy in the world of cricket. A lot been said, an awful lot been written about it as well. And I am talking about the second test down in Port Elizabeth between South Africa and Australia. Been a lot of needle in this one, Carl. I think, we thought the English and the Aussie boys didn't like each other. There's no question, there's no love lost between the two sets of South African and Aussie boys either.
Yeah, you know, Chris, I kind of think once again the media's blown this a little bit out of proportion. And the reason why I'm saying so is this has been happening for years. It's absolutely nothing new between Australia, South Africa, be it South Africa, New Zealand, be it England, Australia. We know sledging has been happening for years and years. The Mike Stumps, I personally not such a big fan of them, because I kind of think it gives people insight into the game, which I don't think is beneficial to any of the parties. And basically to sum it up, Warner had said something to the Cock. The Cock had said something to him, maybe a bit of a personal comment, and he's now, you know, it blew out of proportion. And at the end of the day, I believe if you want to give it, you've got to be able to take it. So David Warner, if you want to go out sledging there and somebody says something that you're not happy about, then don't start in the first place, mate. But I think at the end of the day, it's kind of healthy. It's what Test match cricket is all about. And I, from a personal perspective, just happy the South Africans got their act together and were able to win the second test down in Port Elizabeth.
Aye, aye, aye. Mark Archer with a wry smile on his face because Scotland were saved a couple of moments ago by a knock-on. Not saved now. Italy are rampant.
No, again, it was a try disallowed just after half-time, but it's Tommaso Allan who's scoring points at Wilto. That's his second try of the match, and he's also kicked a couple of conversions as well. The former Scotland under-18 player has now scored two tries against Scotland for Italy, and they've gone back to the lead 22 points to 12. I guess to say it's a pretty kickable conversion. I'm backing him to get it. What that will mean, though, 5 minutes into the second half, Italy will lead Scotland 24 points to 12.
Long way back now for Scotland. Gregor Townsend is going to need to produce something in the next 20 minutes or so. Scotland still time on the clock, but they are under the cosh. And I can tell you as well, there has been another goal in the FA Cup. Let me just break away from our chat, all things cricket, to bring you that because, well, Tottenham, if Italy are rampant, Tottenham are home and hose because it's now Swansea 0, Tottenham 3 at the Liberty Stadium. Ashen faces being worn by those Swansea players. They've been they've just been outplayed today, outfought and outplayed by Spurs. They give the ball away in midfield. Eric Dier pinches the pocket of one. Lucas Moura picks it up, feeds the ball into Eric Dier. Across goal it goes. Lucas Moura with it. They're toying with this Swansea team. He leaves it on a plate for Christian Eriksen, the second of the day for the Dane. Eric Lamella scoring the other one. It's Swansea now 0, Tottenham 3. They are now safely, I think we can safely say, into that semi-finals of the Emirates FA Cup. Just to come back to all things cricket in Australia against South Africa, you mentioned Warner, and I'm completely with you on that, Carl. If you're going to dish it, you've got to be able to take it. And that, despite we've all heard the rumours about what Quinton de Kock said to David Warner about his wife, he's just going to man up. He has said some things that we are told and we are reliably informed he has said to a few of the English boys during the Ashes. Just got to man up. If you're able to dish it, you got to take it. Question for you, though, Mark Archer. Kagiso Rabada, what a performance, an inspired performance. 11 wickets for 150. His fourth 10-wicket haul in just 28 test matches. The boy's just 22 years of age. What a bright future he has. Temperamental, it's fair to say. I just want to get your thoughts on the ban. He was given 3 demerit points. It was level 2, code of conduct violation, for essentially brushing past Steve Smith. He got the wicket of the Australian skipper. He shouted some profanities, I think, in the face of Steve Smith. He was clearly pumped up, and he was essentially done, or the referee took the decision that he was a little too over-aggressive with the way that he brushed past Steve Smith. How did you see it?
First and foremost, it's a shame for South Africa and Rabada that he's now going to miss the final two test matches of the series. 1-1, it's been a great series. All the banter about the sledging and the off-the-field stuff and this, it's been a great, great series of ebb and flow test cricket between two teams playing pretty much at their best stuff. And that's been great for me. But it's just a shame that the leading bowler for South Africa now is probably going to miss those two test matches. Fast bowlers need aggression. They need to express it. He's just gone over the line a couple of times. He's a young man. He's still really learning his trade in test cricket. And I think emotions have got the better of him in this test match. And look, he's been warned. It's not the first time he's overstepped the line. He's been warning. He's accumulated these sort of demerit points or these suspended sentence. And unfortunately, that's life. And he knew about it, and this team knew about it, and he had some issues with that in the first test match, and he hasn't learnt them, and he's now going to pay the price, which unfortunately for him and South Africa is not going to be around. But I think they have Morne Morkel to come back into the team, who was dropped for the second test match, and he's not a bad player. He might be a bit fired up in what is his last series as an international cricketer. So it might have a point to prove, but they'll go down to Cape Town for that match finishing on Thursday, one apiece. And the quality of cricket has been outstanding. Two really evenly matched teams. Just looking afield to Thursday, there's also another great series taking place in New Zealand. New Zealand taking on England, two well-matched teams as well. So we're seeing some great, you know, hopefully the rejuvenation here, a bit of test cricket here with some really well-fought series. How good was AB de Villiers in that last test match? Oh. All the other batsmen were making batting look difficult, were struggling, the pitch and the bowlers were on top. The one man head and shoulders above any batsman on either side, world-class AB de Villiers. He was amazing. And a lot of talk before this test match and up into the series was AB de Villiers had not, it started losing interest in cricket. He didn't want to play test cricket. He'd played so much cricket in short space of time. He was earning all this money playing, you know, in the T20 leagues and ODI stuff. We didn't think we would see him again playing test cricket, but he's come back with a bang. And this is what he had really interesting to say about test cricket and his desire to play cricket full stop after the test match.
No, it's 10 out of 10. It was right up there with the best feeling ever. I was so relieved. I was very nervous in the 90s.
I don't think it showed, but I was telling Vern out there, I'm struggling to breathe there. My legs literally went numb. It's funny when a guy that's played for 13, 14 years say that, but it's true. It really meant a lot to me to get that 100. And I was constantly reminding myself throughout the 90s, it's not about yourself. It's about contributing as much to the team as possible. And that sort of made me feel a little bit better. Because the minute you focus too much on individual performance, you sort of forget about the team. But it's difficult to forget about the team when you haven't scored 100 for 3 years. So it meant a lot to me today. I've never lost my love for the game. I was just tired of playing. I was just flat, physically, mentally, and quite a few other factors. I mean, I became a dad, and at the same time, all of a sudden, two boys are around, and I've got a family. So a lot of things were happening, and then I was taking the pressure with the cricket. So there was just a lot that was going on in my life, and I felt like I just needed to breathe a little bit. So I won't say I lost the love for the game. I think that showed today. I love playing. Look, I can't speak for him. I just have a lot of sympathy in a way. I'm not a bowler, but I can't imagine being a bowler, having to toil out there, run in. It's hard on the body, it's hard on the mind. You get a breakthrough, you just want to celebrate, and that's his way. I mean, obviously he's crossed the line a couple of times, and I think he's regretting that. But I'm glad I'm not a bowler, because I think I would have been worse than him.
That's AB de Villiers there after that 126 knock that helped South Africa level up the series. He was talking about young Kagiso Rabada, such a huge fan of him. I don't think aggression is a bad thing in any sport. I think if you take that out, if you take the passion out, then what is the point of it all? Did he cross the line with Steve Smith? Honestly, I've got to say I don't think he did. I think what has counted against him is the fact that he's had too many indiscretions in such a short space of time, and they've looked to make an example of him. A little earlier this week, we caught up with the Aussie broadcaster Glenn Mitchell. To just put you in the picture, Arch, he echoed with what you said. He said that they were making an example of him, that he felt that he did overstep the mark, and it was important that they made an example of him to show the rest of the young players that it isn't acceptable. I tend to disagree with that, but this is what he had to say on Kagiso Rabada moving forward.
The one thing I will say about Rabada is that if he can stay focused, I think he will go down in history as the most successful fast bowler of all time. He already has 130 test wickets, and Glenn McGrath, who has the most, 563, he's got 160 wickets at an age before McGrath even debuted for Australia.
Wow.
I mean, he is remarkable. He could well end up with 600, 650 test wickets as a fast bowler. When you've got nearly 150 and he yet to turn 23, but he's just got to make sure that he brings himself under control. Otherwise, he's going to continue to make it difficult for his teammates, because he can't do much as far as wicket-taking when you're in the grandstand.
That was Glenn Mitchell there. Interesting that he's going as far as to say, yes, he's still in the early stages of his career as Kagiso Rabada, but he could go all the way and 600, 650 test wickets. I think he needs to sort out between the ears, because he will be targeted if he continues to, again, perception is that he's overstepping that line.
Yeah, I think, you know, Chris, it's a very, very difficult line to walk, because at the end of the day, you don't want to take that aggression out of him. You don't want to take the fire out of the belly, because that's what makes him great. But I think, you know, it will come with experience. He's still a youngster. You know, yeah, he has played a lot of test cricket, but he's still only 23 years old. And, you know, maybe this is the time where you see it a lot in sports. You know, you can use Mike Tyson as an example, where they kind of need that big arm around them and just, you know, kind of calm them down, but still keep them focused. And I definitely think he does have a bright, bright career ahead of him. I think he's been dealt a bit of a, what should I say, not a fair hand with this incident, because once again, I agree with you. I think that's basically looking at his earlier, you know, discretions to give him this hand up. I think the incident with Steve Smith wasn't too serious. And the thing that upsets me the most is I kind of felt that Australia have been given that advantage now, because South Africa without him and the team are definitely not as potent as if they are with him.
They're certainly a different proposition. One of the other things that an awful lot of cricket observers are discussing is the conduct of players. In the last few months, we saw in the Ashes, The subject of sledging reared its ugly head again. I know Kevin Peterson has come out to say in the last couple of weeks, it's nonsense. Why are we talking about sledging? It is part and parcel of the game. The psychological warfare has always been there. But then we've seen Quinton de Kock, David Warner, off-field transgressions again, putting cricket in a nasty spotlight.
I've got a question for you. Us as the media, us as the supporters, aren't we being too nosy? Don't we want to know too much?
I want to know an awful lot. But why? Because
at the end of the day, these things have been happening for years. Guys, it's not the first series where people have been shown. But all of a sudden, because we now got access to that, everybody kind of forms their opinions. And I often think when it's out there, that players kind of suffer more from it than if the public didn't know.
Absolutely. I completely take that on board. And I am a nosy so-and-so. I want even more access. I think the key is you've got to be that little bit thicker skinned, that you've got to acknowledge, you've got to accept that some things, some, you know, colourful language, industrial language, call it what you will, does take place in a sporting arena, that you've got to be given the option. I know you said earlier you don't like Stump Mike. We talked about this one a couple of weeks ago, Archie, didn't we? I'm a fan of Stump Mike, but give us the option. Give the viewer the option. If they want to hear what is truly going on, click a red button, you know, and take you through and allow yourself to engage and indulge in that, because the way sport is going, it's an entertainment. It's all about wanting to know and wanting more insight into what goes on inside dressing rooms, inside changing rooms, on the field of play, because that is the way that you truly keep the sporting fan and entertained and included in what's going on.
But is there not a limit to it? Because Chris McCarty, how would you feel if there's a camera hovering over you before you're preparing for sports tonight, you're swearing at Robbie Greenfield about something he hasn't prepared, and all of a sudden the listeners out there get a totally different opinion of who you really are?
True, that is very true, and I can say that, yeah, there are one or two of expletives headed in Robbie Greenfield's direction at about 10 to 7 when he's telling me that he's not planned or he's not got a competition question planned. But, yeah, listen, I take that point. I completely do. But, again, I'm not a sportsman, and I'm sure there's an awful lot of people out there or sportswomen that they've got no interest what I and Robbie Greenfield are getting up to at 6.50 on a random Tuesday evening. What there is an awful lot of intrigue is what is going on the sporting arena. But the subject of, I guess, the conduct of cricketers has come under the microscope. Glenn Mitchell, we asked him this question about the future. What needs to be done? Do the umpires need to take a more hands-on approach? This is what he had to say.
I think they are blown up, and sometimes I think they are blown up to a degree that is really not giving credit to what actually happened. I think sometimes we live in this tabloid era nowadays, and you know, everyone's a photojournalist because they've got a camera in the back of their phone, and everyone now, I think, does court controversy and try to find it at every corner that they turn. And I think at times the media can be to blame for blowing things out of proportion. But, you know, the MCC brought in a ruling where yellow and red cards are now available in regard to cricket at all levels. And I think that perhaps that is the sort of thing that they do need to bring in. I mean, if you bowl two full tosses above waist height, you are removed from the bowling attack. You know, that is a law that's written in. I think that maybe, you know, a yellow card is something that needs to come into force. Whether a player is taken from the field or whether Rabada, for example, if blows up, says, well, your penalty is you can't bowl for the rest of this inning. Now, he may blow up seven overs into an inning and, you know, all of a sudden has to field and watch his team chase leather to the boundary. But I think if the authorities are serious, then they do need to lift the penalties, because at the moment, as you quite rightly said, we are seeing more and more of these incidents, which always indicates in life that the penalties aren't severe enough. If the penalties are severe enough, you will find that people will pull their heads in. It's a little bit like overrate. I mean, we go for half an hour beyond scheduled stumps nowadays and still lose four or five overs. If perhaps you said the team will be penalised 10 runs for every over they don't bowl, I can guarantee you that 90 overs would be bowled by stumps every day. If they want to eradicate things, they've got to make stronger penalties, and perhaps the yellow and red card is the way to go. Some fans don't like it, others might, but I think if they came into vogue, you would find very quickly that there would be a tidy-up in regard to on-field behaviour.
I made the point on last night's show as well, Glenn, that perhaps the umpires are a little too passive. You know, I often think they're hiding behind the television umpire, that they're not making key decisions. They're not bold enough. They're not brave enough to actually grab a control of the match out there on the wicket. Is that something you agree with?
Oh, wholeheartedly. I mean, you can't tell me that these umpires aren't within earshot of what is being said. I mean, David Warner fields at mid-off normally.
Yeah.
So the umpire at the bowler's end, if this bloke is talking from 15 metres away and is yapping at De Villiers or whoever at the non-striker's end, the non-striker is standing 3 metres from the umpire. The umpires do have a major role in this. They need to step in and say, button it. But again, perhaps if they then said, if you don't shut up, you're going to be off the ground until the tea break or whatever with this card situation, then maybe that was the thing that they need. I just think if they're serious about cleaning up behavioural issues, they need to do something that provides the players with more to think about. And, you know, at the moment, David Warner, for example, earns over $4 million Australian dollars a year. He was fined 75% of his match fee for what happened in Durban. Yes, he did get carryover demerit point. But 75% of a match fee for an Australian cricketer is $13,000. If you're earning $4 million a year, it's probably not that great a disincentive, is it? No. But if they did bring in more suspensions, bring in either suspensions during a play, that you're off the ground for a certain time, perhaps that would have a greater benefit. Because at the moment, these men are multi-millionaires. I'm not too sure that $10,000, $12,000, $8,000 fines is really giving them the same amount of impact that a suspension would. Because if you get suspended, it affects your teammates. And the morale will change within a group if David Warner is not available to play for Australia, much the same as Tagiso Rabada is not available to play the remainder of the series for the Proteas.
That is Aussie journalist and broadcaster Glenn Mitchell's thoughts. You were listening intently there, Archie. Raises a few interesting points, does Glenn. Umpires for you doing enough? Do they need to stand up a little bit?
They do. The problem, I agree with a lot of things he's saying. The problem I have with his argument is on the red cards and yellow cards and umpires taking more charge on the field. I agree with that, but it's a bit about the discussion of where is the line? Mm. What can be said? What can't be said? What's heard? What's not heard? Where is the line? Because it becomes a very subjective subject. Yeah. What might be offensive to some umpires who were ex-players and have been there and done that may be more offensive than to some other umpires or to some other match referees. So it's such a subjective call on that. And it's a bit like saying, well, you know, we talk about a lot of football and referees, you know, the players dominate a football match and they bully the referees and they manhandle the referees and they speak to the referees in football. Unlike rugby, where the captain is very respectful and the captain is the only person who answers to the referee there. So we have to find some solutions for it. You know, I kind of came from the era where, you know, sledging was pretty prominent, but, you know, we're in a social media era. And
You actually said you played better when they sledged you.
I enjoyed it. I liked being sledged because it meant, for me, I struggled to concentrate unless I was in a pressure situation. So I wanted players giving it to me, whether it be bowlers or wicketkeepers or slipfielders, giving me a hard time because it means I could actually focus on something in the match. But, so some players, and I remember, you know, I told you this story last week, guys like Steve Waugh for Australia loved giving it and loved receiving it, and he loved batting in a situation where they were 3 for 30 and all the pressure was on him, and he revelled in those situations. So opposing captains and teams would say, when Steve Waugh comes to the crease, don't sledge him, don't speak to him, just ignore him. And he struggled in those scenarios. So again, it's a very subjective subject where is the line, what is over the line, what can you say, how can it be interpreted? It's a bit, and I'll give you this story. When I played cricket down in South Africa, I used to get sledged in Afrikaans. Players used to come in and give me a hard time in Afrikaans, and I used to say, look, I don't speak Afrikaans, you're going to have to speak English, because I can't understand what you're saying, and I can't think of a smart reply, because you're sledging me in a language I don't understand. So I used to have that situation, you know, take place. So again, it's like in rugby as well, where the South African players will speak in a different language, speak in Afrikaans to try and talk about what's going on. So, you know, that's the problem with cricket, the subjectiveness of what's a sledge, what's not a sledge, where's the line, what can you say, what can't you say.
I think, you know, moving away from it, I think to echo what you said, Carl, or maybe it was yourself, Arch, take all the nonsense and all the noise away. And it is disappointing. I'm gutted that Kagiso Rabada is not going to be able to line up against Australia, because he is box office and he makes it that much more intriguing to watch. Having said all of that, though, what an incredible test match this has been. And the little needle has added to that, hasn't it? Because I can't recall in a long time such an evenly matched two teams who are going absolutely at it, who are literally have got some wonderful performers. AB de Villiers, Steve Smith, Kagiso Rabada, Mitchell Starc. It's been absolutely brilliant thus far.
Oh, it's been a great series, and it's a shame. We don't want to lose players from that series because of that. And there's some great comments made by Simon Katic after the match. The Australian opener was talking about where is the momentum in the series now? Who's the difference? And, you know, look, AB de Villiers, for me, the best batsman on both teams. We talk about how prolific Steve Smith.
Come on now. Come on now.
Oh, what's Archie. He done? What's he done under pressure? They've sorted him out a bit. They've found a way to get to Steve Smith.
I have to agree with you. I mean, he's a great batsman nonetheless. But on this tour...
I'm taking AB de Villiers on South any form of cricket over Steve Smith any day of the week.
No chance. Oh. Absolutely no chance. You're picking Steve Smith in the Test arena.
You get my vote, Mark Archer. You get my vote.
I'm picking...
AB de Villiers over Steve Smith in Test any day over the last 24 months.
No, I'm not saying that. Over 24 months. I'm saying right now... I'm picking a team. I'm picking AB de Villiers in
nonsense.
Every format of the game. Test cricket, ODI cricket, T20, in any condition, in any scenario. Don't get me wrong. AB de Villiers is a better cricketer than Steve Smith. His record's not the same, but I'm picking him under a pressure situation, playing for your country, holding that batting line up together.
What did Steve Smith do in the Ashes?
Against England. You'd get runs against England in Australia, Chris Picardy. Steve Smith just batted for days. AB de Villiers under pressure against Mitchell Starc, you know, David Warner in his ear, having to score runs for his country under pressure, under immense pressure, holding it when no batsman on either team scored a run in a low-scoring test. AB de Villiers in both innings was head and shoulders above other. But let's just listen to Simon Cattich talk about that great second test match in Port Elizabeth.
Amazing test match. It's been a phenomenal series so far. It's ebbing and flowing throughout. Both teams will feel like they're getting momentum, and then all of a sudden the other team comes back and gets on top. And South Africa gained a lot from this test match. They've seen how they can beat Australia now in these conditions. They wore them down with the ball, and then they got the rewards later on in the test match when Australia had to come out and bat with the ball reversing.
Would it break the visitors' hearts this morning losing Mitchell Marsh in the first over after Usman Khawaja went late last night? We saw it when they were bowling at the end with 80 more runs, 100 more runs in it. It was anyone's game.
Yeah, 200 would have been a tough chase for South Africa, and it just goes to show that that first innings of 243 was below par compared to what happened in Durban. And in the end, that's probably the difference in the test match. I think Australia certainly had the opportunity to set this test match up. You know, none for 98 on day one, just before lunch. They lose Bancroft. All of a sudden, after the break, they lose a few more wickets. So I think from that point of view, they'll look back on the test and think day one was where they lost it. And then AB de Villiers coming into the test, you know, early on day three with that magnificent 100, batting with the tail and setting a South Africa up for a big first innings lead. That was the difference in the end.
On radio, you had de Villiers as man of the match, but you've watched Issa Rabada go about his business for two test matches now. Is he the best fast bowler in the world right now?
Oh, I think without doubt, he's right up there. You know, the way he can get the ball to reverse swing with little change in his action both ways, that's the thing that tests the batsman. And, you know, high-quality batsmen in the Australian team at the moment are finding it hard to counter it because there's no real clues as to which way it's going to go with any changes to his action. So he's been remarkable. It's going to be a real shame if he gets rubbed out for the rest of this series.
You play some of your best cricket well into your mid-30s. AB de Villiers is 34 years old. He looks like he's at the peak of his powers. Why are we talking about him giving away the game?
Yeah, he shouldn't be thinking that. I mean, it's just a number. The way he's playing and his reflexes and the time he's got and just his sheer skill, I mean, there's nothing stopping him playing for, you know, another 4 or 5 years. The issue is, I guess, he's got family. Mm. He's got, you know, maybe wanting to have more time at home with them. So you can understand why priorities change at that point in his career. He's achieved pretty much everything in the game. Although, this is probably his final frontier, beating Australia in South Africa. I don't think he's done that before. Mm. So that's probably the thing that's driving him at the moment. And you know what? It's going to be hard for Australia to stop him now because he's playing as well as he's ever played, and they've got to find a way quickly to be able to counter that.
Australia's top dog, Steve Smith, didn't have the best test match with the bat. Is there the smallest, tiniest chink in the Smith armour when it comes to South Africa?
Look, it's hard for someone to perform as dominant as he has in the last few years to continue on game after game. South Africa have found a way with left-arm orthodox spin in conditions where it has been tricky because there's been, in Durban, there was a little bit of a two-pace nature to the wicket. There was a bit of turn. Maharaj is a quality spinner. And then Dean Elgar found a way to get through as well. So, look, it's something that Steve Smith will be mindful of, but he also knows he's capable of turning it around the rest of this series. So this will hurt, this result, and don't be surprised if Australia bounce back hard in Cape Town.
Before we go, the umpires went off and gave the band a round of applause. You're a massive supporter of them throughout the test match. How good was that?
It was so good. I mean, test cricket needs it. It needs atmosphere. When there's no one at the ground or minimal crowds, there needs to be some atmosphere. The band were magnificent. Great to see them playing. And you know what? Hopefully the umpires have learned a lesson from it.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.